Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today I've got two fascinating conversations with two different experts. In one conversation, I talked to a DSA member, the Democratic Socialists of America, who also happens to be a professor of history at Clemson University, all about the impracticality of the DSA and certain far left groups. And he kind of points the way out of love to where he thinks sort of socialists and other far left folks should go. And I mention this because we at this podcast spend a lot of time talking about the center, which is most of you, or the far right. We make fun of the far left, but I feel like we aren't always constructive about that criticism. So I want to be more constructive because I love all you Americans, and I want everybody to be the most effective version of themselves and engage in the most effective way possible. So that's a super interesting conversation. And then we talked to a reporter at the 74, which is a wonderful education outlet, all about the ESA environment in Arizona. And in that conversation, we really round out the conversation by talking about what the different public policy goals are for education savings accounts supporters and detractors, and how they're often making different risk calculations. And actually, as we were talking, I kind of figured some stuff out about even the way I think about some of this. And so loved both of those conversations. But what I wanted to do was start today with just a brief conversation about sentencing in America. And I mentioned sentencing because as I speak, down in Missouri, there is a man named Brian Dorsey who is being put to death. From what I can tell, he had a petition in front of Mike Parson, the governor of Missouri, to try to stop this execution. And Dorsey pled guilty to murdering Ben and Sarah Bonney in 2006. And these are people who he was related to. It's kind of a tragic story, obviously, as all murders are. What's interesting and caught my attention about this particular death row inmate was that Dorsey's clemency request had more than 70 current and former prison workers arguing on his behalf and for the clemency. And they describe him as somebody who had earned the officer's respect, had been rehabilitated in prison. He was a barber for employees at the prison, which is like a position of incredible trust, as you can imagine. And I'll quote from a column in the KC Star by Timothy Lancaster, who is a former officer at the prison. He said, "The very concept of corrections implies that we want incarcerated people to change their ways. Executing Dorsey would dishonor the hard work he had done to fulfill that objective." I want to say at the outset, my brother is a federal corrections officer, and I have a lot of respect for the people who run our prisons. Often these places are understaffed, and often they're given an impossible task to try to prevent rampant crime within prisons and keep people safe, often without the proper resources. There are a few things that are notable about this. I obviously mentioned the fact that the prison guards, the corrections officers, want this clemency. What's also notable is that this guy pled guilty, which should have mattered, right, in a double murder, right? If you plead guilty, that usually should be done in exchange for a lesser sentence. Then otherwise, why plead guilty? Go through the trial. Roll the dice. If you're going to get death, you might as well just try, right? So what's weird here is he pled guilty, still got a death sentence, right? Number two is that there was some allegation of sexual assault involved here. He was not charged with it, nor obviously convicted of it, but that evidence was presented at sentencing, which I think is a weird quirk in the law that you're allowed to do that. I think there's a lot of things that happen in sentencing that are really weird. The other thing here is that there seems to be no allowance whatsoever for whether you're a model inmate or not, and whether that matters for a death row sentence. I can understand, right? Like if you're a true serial killer or something, it shouldn't matter. But in the case of a double murder like this, it seems like something that should be relevant. The other piece here is that in the clemency application to the governor, Dorsey argued that he had received bad advice from his court-appointed attorney who received a flat fee. So these court-appointed attorneys get a flat fee no matter what the outcome of the case is and no matter how much time they put in. And so when you start to think about, well, okay, how come there wasn't a plea deal negotiated if this guy is going to plead guilty? Well, it's because this lawyer wasn't incentivized in any way to put in extra time and work harder. Now, obviously, there are many public defenders out there who put in the extra time because they care. But this seems to be a travesty of justice. He pled guilty without any agreement from the prosecutors regarding sentencing. It's also interesting that the families of the victim are split here about whether this guy deserves clemency or not. And part of this is because the details here are really horrible. The Missouri officials say that Dorsey was having trouble with drug dealers in December 2006 and sought help from his cousin and her husband, the people he murdered. They invited him to spend the night at their house. And when they went to bed that night, Dorsey took a shotgun and shot the both of them. I mentioned that there's some murky details about whether or not there was sexual assault present. He was not charged or convicted with that. And Dorsey's current lawyers say that Dorsey was in a drug-induced psychosis at the time of the killings, which obviously would be relevant for the charges and sentencing. You know, obviously it has to do with premeditation or not, obviously. You want to save the highest consequences in your criminal justice system for premeditation. And he pled guilty to two counts of first-degree murder, right? Which is weird under the circumstances I just described. I mention all of this because I'm puzzled looking across the country as to what we're doing with sentencing. You know, you look at SBF, who got 25 years in prison, right? Which is, for some people, depending on where you are, like, he might as well have murdered somebody, right? And he committed a horrible financial crime, but by and large, most of the people who were victims of that fraud were made whole, in contrast to Bernie Madoff, or at least made whole as of the period of time in which a certain date was cut off, right? Like, they didn't get the full gains of what they would have had in cryptocurrency for all the past year or so as the trial was going on. But they got most of their money back, right? He should still go to prison. He should still go to prison for a long time, but 25 years, right? There just doesn't seem to be a lot of logic in the system. And I think of this because we have three goals of our criminal justice system: deterrence, rehabilitation, and restitution. And sometimes we just say, we're not going to rehabilitate you. You can't be rehabilitated. But deterrence is really the one we all get behind. And this case of this gentleman in Missouri, to me, is puzzling because so many studies say that the death penalty is not a deterrence. Life in prison, I can attest to you, if somebody talks to my brother on a regular basis, he's in a federal prison, which is a lot better than a lot of other places. Prisons are horrible places. Life in prison is as much of a deterrent as you can imagine. And I'm not sure who we're deterring with this death sentence. Two is the rehabilitation piece. I think everybody's on record saying this guy was rehabilitated. I'm not saying let him out on the streets, but it seems like he was rehabilitated. He has become a better person in prison and is behaving himself and is an upstanding member of a community, which I know we don't think of prisons as communities, but if you're trying to run a prison, if you're a corrections officer, the reason why some of these guys wrote about this is because it's so freaking hard to run a great, like a healthy and safe prison community, that we should listen to the people who run these prisons when they say, hey, this guy's actually been integral to creating such a community. That should matter. And then there's restitution. And in this case, the restitution is murky because some family members want this guy to die and some people don't. But I also think we need to be careful about restitution because killing the person who killed your family member isn't going to bring your family member back. And I remember Dukakis, you know, in the 88 elections, there was a big gotcha moment in the debates where Mike Dukakis, who's the Democratic nominee for president, was debating George H.W. Bush. And the questioner at the debate asked, well, you oppose the death penalty. Well, what happens if somebody like raped and killed your wife? What would you do? And I think, I could be wrong about this, Dukakis kind of waffled in his answer or whatever. What Dukakis should have said was, yeah, I would kill that person with my bare hands. And that's the reason why I shouldn't be on a jury, right? Like, yes, victims' rights matter, but there's a reason why we go through jury selection to try to create the most impartial people as possible, and why judges often give the sentences. And if that judge was related to the victim, that would be absurd, right? Like, yes, we should take into account restitution and all that. In this case, actually, it's murky because there's a split with the family. But obviously, like, if you kill my family member, I'm going to want to kill you myself, right? But that's not how we do things, right? This is not the laws of the jungle. That's one side of the equation. The other side of this equation is that an NYPD officer was recently murdered in New York by a man who had 21 prior arrests. So this is the other side of the equation. So on the one hand, we have this absolutely inflexible, sometimes illogical system for many crimes, depending on where you are. And then in some places, like my home state of New York, there doesn't seem to be any sense of justice the other way, right? How is it possible that somebody who commits 21 crimes is still on the street, right? Like that person should literally be followed around for the rest of their life. And this obviously has led to huge outcry over what's going on here. And this is not an isolated incident. Like Chesa Boudin, when he ran for DA and was DA, was arguing that somebody's priors shouldn't matter at all, which is absolutely wild, right? Like your priors should matter. So all of this, we're going to do more on sentencing, but this was just a reaction I had this morning and reading all of this news. It's like, there should be some sense of proportionality. There should be some sense of logic within the system. And we should balance these different goals, deterrence, rehabilitation, restitution. And we should listen to the people who run our prisons because we put a lot on their shoulders. And it's really important to create environments that are safe for our prisons. And it's also safe for the prison guards and the corrections officers and safe for the inmates. And I think about this, you know, my final analysis is like, it's almost like a running joke, right? That we send people to prison and they get prison rape is like a long running gag in comedy, right? But it's actually appalling. Most of the people who go to prison coming out, right? The idea that we're sending you to prison for a crime and then we're openly admitting that crimes are going to be committed against you in that prison, horrible crimes, some of the worst crimes you could ever imagine, that we just accept that as a society and even joke about it. We need to do more to make these places safe. And I think this is part of it, is like we need to create better incentives for the people who go into prison. We need to staff them better. And we need to listen to the people who run them because they have a lot to say about how we can make these places better. So with that, let's jump into our interviews. I am excited to welcome on Arash Azizi, who is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and senior lecturer in history and political science at Clemson. His new book, What Iranians Want, Women, Life, and Freedom, was just published. Arash, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So you wrote this article that caught our attention. The title is Too Much Purity is Bad for the Left. What prompted you to write this piece?
What really prompted me was an observation that in the United States, people who consider themselves leftist, and I mean, you know, I don't mean sort of the center left or the cultural left. I mean, what you can call the far left or the hard left, you know, socialists, Marxists, that section of the left, they often take very sort of radical positions and they like to place themselves in a international setting. They like to sort of praise countries where the left movements have made certain advances, but they don't actually look at the practice of how is it that the far left, sort of the socialist parties in countries that are successful, what are some of the things that they actually do? So there's something very ironical here that because the United States is one of the countries, one of the relatively few countries actually that doesn't have much of an organized left, it also doesn't have the culture that it comes with having an organized left. And I focus on two things here, you know, one of which is that when you have strong communist parties or Marxist parties or socialist parties, they almost always know how to make a coalition and work with other, you know, center-left parties or liberals, certainly against the far right. That while this is a controversial proposition in the United States, it's just a matter of fact in most countries, as I try to show in the piece. And the other thing I try to show is that, you know, when you do have a successful political movement on the left, as in these other countries, you're going to have to learn how to win elections, govern, either on the national level or on the local level. And so you need to have policies that work on that level and that, you know, to have abstract conversations like, you know, will there be bananas under socialism or will there be restaurants, which are all the real conversation that has happened somewhere on the American left, you know, in the last few months, are really not helpful. So what I try to do with the piece is to bring some lessons, vistas, if you will, from, you know, from several other countries around the world that do have a serious left.
Yeah. And one of the groups you focus on is Democratic Socialists of America. And, you know, I could just tell you from my experience, I've been very involved in New York City politics for a long time. And, you know, a couple of years ago when I was really helping candidates at the primary level and DSA was kind of primary, like, you know, fielding candidates that were on the opposite side of many of our races. One thing that we were picking up was the DSA was like emphasizing things like questions like, do you support a Green New Deal and things like that? And it's like, you know, this is a city council races, you know, so it's people are like, well, is the trash getting picked up? Do our schools do a good job of educating our kids? Are the streets safe? Is there a good balance between safety and justice and fairness? And what I was struck by was just how impractical all the conversations were that DSA was having, that they were almost, like you said, they're having this almost theoretical conversation, almost like they're in a political science seminar. No offense to you political scientists.
Well, I'm not one. I'm a historian, so you can offend political scientists. I do teach in a political science department, but I'm a historian.
But yeah, so number one, tell us a little about who DSA is. And number two is what I observed, something that you've seen from this organization.
Democratic Socialist of America, of which I'm also a member, I should say, as I tried to say, you know, DSA is an organization that goes back to 1980s. I won't get into the deep depth of its history, but it's really a achievement of a particular, of several different forces that had mostly come to almost disappear in the 70s. And by the early 80s, something is salvaged out of them. And so it has one roots in New American Movement, which was one of the founding organizations of the DSA, which really came out of the 60s, right? The long 60s. And another founding organization of the DSA was called Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee that came out of the Socialist Party of the United States. That's America, of course, did have a very serious far-left organization, Socialist Party in the 20th century, which really splits into three different factions in the 1970s. And Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, led by a guy called Kit Harington, its goal was to organize socialist politics inside the Democratic Party as a broad tent. So, I mean, I can't get into history really, but this is the sort of broad historical outlines of what it is. But DSA remained a member of the Socialist International, which is an international gathering of center-left parties. And, it remained an organization of a few thousand members until 2016. It's 2016 where Bernie Sanders, who wasn't a member of the DSA, but who came from the same political family, if you will, of people who are socialists, but also Democrats. So democratic socialism, really, it's this broad camp. Bernie Sanders' campaign led tens of thousands of young people to join DSA. Its membership ballooned at some point to being more than 90,000. It has now deflated again, I think, 70,000. So the interesting thing is that DSA is the largest sort of socialist organization the United States has had in a very long time. In some ways, the last time the organization was this large and had, you know, this many branches all over the country, it was probably the Communist Party back in its heyday in the 50s. Or some of the groups probably in the 60s, that if you sort of count them all together. Now, so this is sort of the history of the DSA. Now, part of this growth that the organization had in the last decade or so was that it effectively lost its focus and coherence, whereas it had been a very coherent organization that had internal differences, but it cohered around the version of democratic socialism. And simultaneously, what happened was that at one level, it was diluted because, of course, it's young people who were excited to join because, you know, they had a vague idea of Bernie Sanders being a socialist. They came with a bunch of different ideas, but also they didn't have a culture of political organization. So these are not people who go to meetings. These are not people who, membership in DSA is a pretty meaningless thing. You sign a thing, you pay $5 a year or something, and you're considered a member. And at the same time, also a variety of hard left groups entered this organization, DSA, and then they effectively tried to wrest away the leadership. And they came with, these are groups that for a very long time, what really defined this American hard left, if you will, was its first commandment in the Ten Commandments was that thou shalt never run as a Democrat. So there was something very ironic, effectively, of this organization that had defined, that had spent decades trying to so-called build a third party or dismantle the two-party system, effectively admitted defeat and joined an organization that, after all, its entire raison d'etre had been working on the Democratic ballot line. So this created this current condition that you have, that DSA is full of very contradictory impulses. You know, it's a both party of people like Bernie Sanders, and Bernie himself is not a member, but like AOC and these others who really come from this tradition of, you know, wanting to get elected in the United States and do something inside the Democratic Party. We can talk about what that is.
Is she currently a member of DSA? Yes. I vaguely remember her saying she was leaving in response to some of the October 7th stuff, but I might be mis- remembering.
No, I think she's definitely a member. I don't think she's left. I don't think she's left. Although it doesn't, as I said, it's not clear what it means, right? You're a member, I'm a member, she's a member, many other people are members. It's not always clear what it means. Jamal Bauman is someone who got hounded out of the DSA effectively and left, for example. Which is interesting.
Who was, you said? Who is so
Jamal Bauman, a congressman from
Jamal Bauman. Yeah. And why was he hounded out? What was the rest?
Well, it's ironic. You know, it's like a sitcom. You know, he was hounded out by not being pro-Palestine enough by a bunch of groups. And I say it's like a sitcom because, of course, Jamal Bauman is probably, you know, easily the top three most pro-Palestine member of the Congress by any definition of the term, really. But because he did go to Israel and he also visited the occupied Palestinian territories in the West Bank, and that, but the very fact that he went on this trip led some people to effectively hound him out, call for his expulsion. And there was a lot of internal drama in the DSA about that. But, you know, to back to the city council thing, if I may briefly say, you know, there are conditions in which you can run political campaigns, perhaps, and do even advocate for national policies on a local level. I don't know. It depends on the particular race. But the question is bigger than that, right? The problem, as I said, is that what is the strategy? Like, what are we trying to do here? And the fundamental problem with the DSA is that it includes people who are trying to do radically different and, in fact, opposing things. And it has prided itself for a long time on being a big tent organization. When the organization is very small, you like people of different groups to get together and sort of figure out what to do inside it. But there's so much of a big tent you can have. Like, you can't have, and as I tried to say in the piece, you can't have someone who wants Biden to be president and Ukraine to be supported and for NATO to be strengthened, and someone who thinks, I don't know, electoral politics is a sham and Russia invaded Ukraine because of NATO expansionism and that the United States shouldn't do anything to support Ukraine. I mean, these are really fundamentally opposing political programs. And you can have political parties, and in Europe, we can talk about it. There are political parties which have deeply different structures inside, but you cannot have two positions when it comes to an election. You're not a political organization if you have two different lines when it comes to a political election. And on the presidential elections, both this year and 4 years ago, for the first time in the history of the DSA, effectively, actually, don't quote me on that. I haven't followed every presidential election in the history of the DSA, but I think there have been some differences as well. But in this election, and definitely, well, this election, we don't really know yet what's going to happen, what we can guess. But in 2020, DSA effectively pursued diametrically opposed strategies for the elections, right? So some wanted Biden to get elected and some didn't or didn't do anything towards that. In fact, effectively, you know, they helped the other side, frankly, if you ask me. So, you know, these are some of the basic problematics that appear in the organization.
And it does seem like they're shaping up to, I mean, signs point to the DSA, like they've, correct me if I'm wrong, they've been a driving force behind this unaffiliated campaign in the primaries for people to vote unaffiliated instead of for Biden. And it seems like they're reluctant to endorse Biden, which means that they could play a role in either discouraging turnout of their members or for their members to show up and not vote for a presidential candidate. Is that your read on it?
Yeah. So first of all, I do want to acknowledge that there are many reasons to be mad at President Biden and try to sort of pressure him. And technically, a unpledged campaign in the primary is, you know, doesn't mean you don't support the candidate. In fact, the very point of taking part in a primary is that you accept the process and you will vote for whoever is the president at the end. So I certainly hope those who have taken part in the primaries and have shown their anger at Biden's policies and through these democratic processes also do turn up for him and vote for him in November. Now, as for what DSA's position it will be, so what happened in 2020 was that DSA's convention had voted, you know, in what is, I don't know what adjective to use, but certainly not a very politically sophisticated movie. They had voted that they would only support Bernie Sanders and no one else. So we were at a bizarre, obscene, if you will, condition that if Elizabeth Warren had been a candidate, DSA would still have not supported her, i.e. if United States might have had the most left-wing presidential candidate by far in its history, and DSA would still say it would sit it out because she just happened to be not Bernie Sanders and not a socialist, right? But when Biden was, at any rate, That's not the eventuality that happened. Biden was a nominee. DSA very loudly declared that it wasn't endorsing Biden. You know, it didn't just not endorse Biden or not show it enough. It very loudly declared, we're not endorsing Biden. And what it also did was that there was a vote in the DSA leadership that should it be perhaps that DSA calls on its members in swing states to consider voting for Biden, right? The most conditional form of attempt to defeat electoral Trump and to electorally defeat Trump. And even that was unfortunately heavily defeated. This was a far cry, by the way, with 2016. By 2016, DSA hadn't endorsed Hillary Clinton, hadn't used these words, but they had joined the campaign to defeat Trump. Effectively, they called on people to go vote for Hillary Clinton. They, as I said, didn't call it endorsing Hillary, but they said that they were voting to defeat Trump, which of course the only way to do that was to vote for Hillary Clinton. So that's what they did in 2020. As for what will happen this year, I mean, I don't, you know, we got to see. But with the current composition of the National Political Committee, the leadership of the DSA, which is even more captured by the hard left groups, if you will, compared to the last one, it's very likely that effectively they'll, I mean, I don't know what they'll do on the final ballot, but certainly not endorse Biden. I'll be very surprised if they do anything like endorsing Biden. And the other thing I should tell you, you know, Michael Harrington, who was one of the founder, really the founding father person of the DSA. And, you know, he's a very fascinating guy. We can go sort of look at his ideas. I mean, he was able to keep this socialist organization together in the US through the very hard decades. The current attitude of much of this sort of people who sit in the DSA leadership toward Harrington is very open. I mean, not only criticism, but I seriously think, and I hope, you know, if they think otherwise, they can come and say it. I think they basically think him almost a moron. I mean, they have no regards for the kind of careful strategies of realignment and Democratic Party and how you should work inside a Democratic ballot line that he represented. And I guess that's, you know, it's any organization can change, but it does pose a question for those of us who think that was a political tradition worth following to face it. Unfortunately, many people don't face it because they like to have this, put this unity hats on and say, oh, we should all be in this together. But I really, as I said, you cannot have these diametrically opposed positions in an organization for very long. It will explode in someone's face at some point.
Yeah, what's interesting is in your piece, you talk about the international comparisons. And for the most part, what's interesting about the successful examples of socialist or communist organizations enacting change, usually through coalitions, is in parliamentary systems. And I wonder whether the sort of unique two-party system in the US and the way that we do primaries is partially at issue here. Like, you know, you mentioned Kerala, for example, in India, where there's a strong history of communist party organizing there. And it's a really fascinating history that I don't have time to go into.
But the communist government right now, by the way, in Kerala.
Yeah. And so they have coalitions. There are pockets of places in some of these countries, India being an example, that are majority support communism, right? Which is rare in the US. I mean, one could point to certain places, Asheville, North Carolina, or something. It's a joke. I don't actually know if that's true.
I live very close to Asheville. It's just rumors of socialism are exaggerated.
Yeah. But there's also, I think, a branding issue I think the DSA has, which is, and I'm not sure whether this is fair or not, but it is viewed, at least within New York City, as an organization of upper income folks, more dominated by upper income white progressives. And that they're often at odds with what's called the Eric Adams Coalition, which was coming from East New York and the Bronx, et cetera. And if you look at sort of the electoral maps on a lot of these races, the DSA hadn't done well, at least in my city, in the lowest income, most minority-centered districts. Whereas if you look at India, some of the, you know, biggest support for communists had traditionally come from some of the poorest, most forgotten parts of India. But okay, that's a huge question for you as we round out here. So maybe just a couple of thoughts on that before I let you go. And people should go read this piece, by the way, because it goes into that sort of international comparison and what you think the way out is for the DSA.
Yeah, so you know, let me not get into the sort of class composition of the DSA because, I mean, I think we should actually study it and look at it. But it's definitely that true that a lot of the active layers are, I think most people in the DSA would agree it's too white, frankly, to be clear. By too white, I mean, compared to the composition of the country, right? You want your organization to look like the country, and especially look like the working classes, let's say, which would mean, you know, I don't know, a healthy socialist organization in the United States should be fighting between 20 to 30% black, let's say, right? Because that's roughly the composition of working class in much of the country. And, you know, that's not the case in the SA. But it's a sort of a specific question. But let me go back to your first part of your question. I don't think the system in the United States is unique, and it does pose unique problems, but I don't think it's the main thing at issue here. You know, there are a couple of ways to talk about this, but first of all, let me say that we do also have coalition governments in the US effectively. It's just, they're just organized under the name of the one party, right? But every Democratic or Republican administration is effectively a coalition of very different forces. The government now, it's obviously a coalition, right? Bernie Sanders is a big part of this government, for example. Yes, he doesn't have a seat in the cabinet because we don't have that kind of a system, but, you know, he's obviously part of the Democratic Party establishment by this point, right?
Yeah, so this is an interesting point. But what if, I think part of the issue is, it's hard to draw a straight line for that disaffected DSA member, for example, and a good example is the Palestinian issue, right? Like, it's hard to draw a straight line between voting for any Democrat and them registering that, hey, I have some support from people who may have a different position on some of these issues than me, then say voting in members of your party who then can negotiate in very transparent ways as part of the coalition, right? Like, you could say, all right, we're gonna vote for members of the Liberal Democratic Coalition in the UK, and we know eventually they're gonna form a coalition with the Labour Party, but they will have way more negotiating power because I voted for them. Theoretically, that's kind of how the primary should work, but it doesn't seem to work that way.
No, but it does work that way. In some ways, it does work that way. Look, I mean, the process is, you know, the process is always going to be different, right, in each country. But actually, let me give you an example. I mean, in Portugal, right, if you vote for, let's say, the Portuguese Communist Party or the Left Bloc, which is a sort of a similar force, right? Well, what do you know? First of all, you know they're not going to form the government. That's what you know. In terms of, if you're talking about government, right, you know they're not going to form a government. So all that is left is them having to either support a government led by the Socialist Party or join a government led by the Socialist Party, but they still have to negotiate. So what's the equivalent in the United States? Well, first of all, you can try to run candidates that are closer to you in various primaries around the country. And also in the presidential elections, how much of a vote does a candidate gain in the primary is very immediately translates to political power, very clearly, right? Pete Buttigieg, transport secretary, right? Because he was a mayor of South Bend, Indiana, right? Because he ran a successful primary campaign. So if you want to do it, you can do that. And anyways, you have to, associates, you have to work with the political system that you are given, right? You can also try to change it, but we shouldn't forget that, as I said, socialists tried to change the system in very bad ways for a very long time. And there's something about, the United States doesn't actually have a two-party system. It has a no-party system, because this country doesn't have political parties the way they exist anywhere else in the world, right? You don't have an organization where you join, when there's party discipline, where you can set the policies. And, you know, there are people, if you read in Jacobin, there's a great article called sort of a blueprint for a new party, which explains this issue of ballot line. And, you know, people have talked about this stuff for a long time. The fact of the matter, though, is that, you know, you're not going to get rid of the basic problems that exist with a different political system. The basic issue is you have 330 million people in this country, right? And they have now coalesced into two big political families. The question for the nascent socialists, and we have to be honest and humble, socialism is still a very small force in this country, right? It's a smaller growing force. It has a choice to make as to what it wants to do with this actually existing political field. Look, I live at least for another few weeks in South Carolina, right? Upstate South Carolina. In upstate South Carolina, let's say, socialists would have a choice. Do they want to join with a broad, progressive, a bit anti-racist, passes for Democratic Party in upstate South Carolina? And it actually does include everything that leftists should want. It includes anti-racism. It includes trade unions. It includes women's rights. It includes being pro-choice when it comes to abortion, right? Does it want to join this coalition, or does it want to say, no, I hate both of you equally, right? It's a very basic choice. And I think it's an obvious choice, frankly. If you look at from the perspective of all over the country, it's obviously a different perspective if you're in Brooklyn, right? Which is where a good big chunk of the SA members are, or in other places where, you know, you look at the world in this way. And also, let me also clarify this. If someone wants to dismantle the two-party system, be my guest. By running a third party who would get 2% of the vote and disappear by the next election is not dismantling the two-party system. And all it is, as I said, refusing to place yourself in the most important political battles, which will also, and this is the key thing, it's not like if you stand outside this, you will then eventually grow and then become this massive force, which is what some socialists pretend will happen and has never happened and will never happen. What happens is that you set yourself out as a buffoon, you become politically irrelevant, and you put yourself outside the realm of actually existing politics effectively.
Well, on that sunny note, thank you so much, Arash. Everybody go out there and read this piece in The Atlantic. It's called Too Much Purity is Bad for the Left. We'll link to it in the show notes. We'll also link to Arash's book, What Iranians Want, Women, Life, and Freedom. Arash, this was wonderful. Thank you, man, for joining us.
Of course. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, I am excited to welcome on Linda Jacobson. She is a senior writer for the 74 covering Congress, policy, courts, early education, and more. She began covering schools for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and has been writing about education for a decent amount of time, and we have referenced her articles for a while now. Linda, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Linda, you have covered a lot of this sort of recent forces that are sort of making profound change in our school system. And I want to start with just a theory, which is between artificial intelligence, ESAs, the increasing polarization of our politics, and obviously the post-pandemic environment. It feels like we're in an unprecedented era of change and turbulence within our school systems. Do you feel that?
Yes, for sure. I think that there are some structural changes happening with public education that have come on hard and fast, I think, in a lot of ways. And maybe people expected some of these things to roll out more slowly, but certainly with ESAs, which I know, you know, we're going to talk about, but, you know, that has really spread quickly.
Yeah. And talking about ESA, so we're talking about education savings accounts. And for listeners, you know, we've covered this a few times, but this is a variation of the voucher concept. We don't really need to go into the mechanism too much because it also changes from state to state, but essentially giving parents funding to take that funding outside of the traditional public school system and even out of the charter system. And depending on what state we're talking about, the laws look pretty different. What can you spend it on? Can you spend it on homeschooling? Could you spend it on any private school? Can every student get it? What kind of oversight is there? And that's kind of the space I want to spend some time here. You wrote an article about Arizona. Let's talk about what this law says. You know, Arizona had a history of charter schools. It wasn't necessarily the best charter school law to begin with. But now it has, and for our audience, charter schools are usually, for the most part, nonprofit institutions that run public schools independent of school districts. In certain states, they allow for-profit institutions, that is in the minority of states. But now they have a pretty aggressive ESA bill. Just talk a little bit about, like, you know, how this came about and what does the bill allow for?
Well, their ESA program was around for many years, but it targeted families with children who have disabilities to take some funding and find a better fit for their kids in private schools. And then in 2022, it was expanded to universal program where any family can take these funds. I think, you know, it's an average about $7,500, much larger still if you have a child with disabilities, to use it for homeschooling expenses, kind of build your own curriculum, you know, tutoring, enrichment type classes. And obviously still you can go to a private school. It won't cover the full tuition generally, but will certainly reduce it if a family wants to go that route.
You know, this came up in the debate that I had at the American Enterprise Institute. this is a state that has probably some of the least restrictions on how you could use that money. Say a little bit about that.
Well, there's no accountability requirement regarding learning. So a family, they're supposed to spend the money on the four core curriculum areas, but there's no requirement to take a test. You know, families can certainly have their kids, you know, take an achievement test if they want, but it's not required. I think that, you know, I continue to monitor an ESA Facebook group where I originally got the story idea to find out what families were spending the money on, to talk to some of those families about how they were approaching this. You know, they reach out for suggestions, you know, to each other. And you know, it really is sort of a community. But a lot are pulling their curriculum, you know, off the internet, sharing ideas that way.
To put a fine point on it, so it's like they don't have to take standardized tests, which means they're not accountable to those results. There's not a ton of financial compliance provisions compared to, say, charter schools, which traditionally have to use government accounting and subject themselves to audits that they submit, et cetera. There's no criminal background checks for employees, from what I understand, right? So those are some combinations. I do want to get to the point you made around parents pulling curriculum and all that, and just to get a sense of some of the schools and models, and some of these aren't even schools, they're pods. But before we get there, you wrote a story about some of the consequences of this lack of oversight. So there have been some notable instances of fraud. Is that right?
Yes, there's two that stand out. There was two indictments that come to mind. There were some women who created, I guess, fronts, you know, for using this money, and fake students, that type of thing, where accounts were getting approved in the system by the state, but the money wasn't really going to help any particular child. And then there was also a more recent situation where some staff at the State Department of Ed created a similar scheme where they were creating ghost students, is what the state attorney general called them, and pulling down, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, for these fake accounts.
And you and I talked about this as it was happening, because it happened, it's one of these instances happened just as I was doing the debate.
Exactly. Yeah. The timing was amazing.
Yeah. And thankfully, my opponents didn't realize that. And what I said to you then was actually something that Lisa Snell over at Stand said in your piece, which is, look, fraud happens all the time. And actually, they caught the fraud, which is actually success. And what's interesting is this is an inside job, which is always some of the hardest fraud to catch, right? Like if the regulators are the ones creating these fake accounts, then that's particularly dangerous. So part of me was like, look, like the fact that they caught these people is a good sign. You know, as I mentioned to you in our conversation, I've had many charter school colleagues have issues with financial impropriety, including multiple who have gone to jail for that. You know, Seth Andrew with Democracy Prep, and then Chris Clemens down in Atlanta. You might have been down at the Atlantic Journal Constitution. He literally was a charter school leader who was taking money from the school system and using it in strip clubs. But both of those guys were caught. And actually, in some of those cases, it was exactly the regulations were working for those, which is, and this is why this cuts both ways. In the case of Seth, his board caught it in part through strong board oversight, but also some of the financial systems. That's a healthy sign, I guess. But on the flip side, there's not a lot of requirements to make ESAs operate that way, the way that charters would, in a way that would allow them, you know, to create strong governance, to create transparency, you know, to create board minutes and all these kinds of things that I think do help with this compliance. That's my sense, because even though I don't want to use a double standard for ESAs, but at the same time, I'm warm to the ESAs, but I struggle to see the public policy interest in like the complete lack of oversight.
Well, it's the shifting of accountability. The strong supporters view parents as the ultimate decision makers in whether this is an effective policy or not. That if the parents are happy, that's all that matters. You know, and I think that feels uncomfortable still to some people.
Yeah. And I think like it's what they said in your piece was it's they're worried about death by a thousand cuts regulation. And I sympathize in a way. Like, I think a good example is in New York City, trying to open any business is a checklist of one interest group after another who has some claim to the regulatory environment. And there's some industry that's cropped up around it. And basically what happens is unless you're incredibly wealthy and well-resourced and well-connected, you can't start certain businesses in highly regulated industries. Not necessarily because you're not the right person to start said thing, but because you don't have the resources or the sophistication to navigate the politics around it. Like a funny example of this is if you watch the Bear TV show, when they're trying to open the restaurant in Chicago, there's like the consultant to the consultant to the consultant, right? And I'm sympathetic to the people who are saying, look, well, we want, you know, you were talking about parents looking for curriculum and all that. They're like, hey, we want like a parent to start a pod of 8 kids and we don't want them to have to go through 9,000 different things and get an account, like a special accountant and yada, yada, yada.
Special sprinklers and so many bathrooms. Yeah, exactly.
Which is why I'm like excited about the federalism about all this. I'm not sure I would want it blanketly implemented the way Arizona is implementing it around the country, but it is fascinating to me to be able to look. And this is where I think we should all like look at this with like as objective a lens as possible. This is what I said to you on the phone, which is like, I'm holding out as objective as a perspective as I could possibly muster here and say, what does it look like? If it's a disaster, then the pro-ESA people have to answer for that. If it leads to a flourishing of low-income parents starting pods and becoming empowered and creating things that we never thought were possible, then I think the anti-ESA people should take notice as well. And honestly, I'm not sure. My suspicion is it'll be probably a mixture of both and it'll be a really complicated picture.
Yeah, I agree. I'm working on a piece right now that'll be out next week about micro schools. Some of them obviously do take ESA funds. And there are clear examples of these smaller settings really helping kids who are struggling in traditional public schools. And especially if the leader of that micro school, you know, has training in working with kids, you know, who have dyslexia or and sometimes not even the specific training is necessary, but just can give that child the time. You know, it's similar to what we see with, you know, the benefits of tutoring. You know, it's that more personalized, you know, individualized time that can work in a micro school, can work through tutoring as well.
And tell us, number one, like what constitutes a micro school? And two, give us an example of something you saw out there, like a particular micro school that caught your attention.
A micro school, you know, would be, I think the average size is about less than 20 kids or so. There are some that are running fairly large, you know, as large as like 100 kids. But often they start from what we learned during the pandemic as a pod, where it might have started in somebody's home, where some homeschool families got together and decided, let's pool our efforts and, you know, maybe we can even hire a teacher or hire somebody who has some, you know, education skills, you know, and it gets big enough to where maybe you don't want to have it in your home. You want an actual commercial space or a church basement or something where a little more conducive to people coming together. I think predominantly the people opening micro schools are former educators who decided they still wanted to teach, but in a different type of setting. You know, it really becomes kind of a passion for them. Some of these micro schools, it really just means small school. You know, some of them do get the core part of their curriculum from an online provider. And then their primary role would be some of the enrichment stuff and doing field trips and doing innovative types of things with, you know, with kids.
Yeah. You know, an interesting analogy is, you know, I was at the State Department when we were doing these sort of campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan and all that. And like, we were doing this nation building, right? And I'll put aside the sort of question about whether nation building was a wise project to begin with. But let's assume for a second that we agree that nation building is a strong project. The debate that was happening at the time was, is it better to get a lot of money out there to get a lot of projects going and take the risk of fraud, but also give people the freedom to do it fast you know, and make things happen? Or like, do we need more controls on that money? And that was a debate. And like the upsides and downsides were obvious, but it was hard to know, right? Which is like, we don't want people to be frustrated. We don't want projects to never get off the ground and all that. But we also don't want to put a whole bunch of money out there that just gets totally corrupted by the system, right? And I think it's partially an analysis of like where the money's going and how people can use it. And that's where I'm so fascinated to see what happens in Arizona, because like if you're a pro ESA person, what you're saying, an anti-ESA person is saying, let's say that there are 10 schools out there, micro schools, each with 20 kids. If one of those schools is a fraud, the program is a failure, right? And maybe even one out of 100 if they're a fraud, right? Because what we're talking about is like every time there's a story that's viewed as a failure, right? But it also could be indicative of more fraud, obviously. So I want to be charitable to what people are saying. Just because we caught one doesn't mean there aren't 10 more for every one that we caught. The pro-ESA people will say, I don't know if they'll say this explicitly, but this is kind of their logic that I'm picking up on, is there are 10 schools and 5 of them are absolutely wonderful, 4 of them are mediocre, and 1 of them is a fraud, that is well worth it. Or 3 of them are wonderful, 3 of them are mediocre, 3 of them are frauds, maybe even that's worth it, right? So there's like a different risk calculus that I think people are playing with here.
Because they'll point to the public schools and say, how many are, you know, failing.
Right, yeah. Failing, fraud, like obviously there's fraud within the public school system stipulated, but I think anybody, even the most pro-ESA people would say that there are, like we're talking about like the true fraud, right? They would say it's all fraud, but the true fraud is harder to do in a public school system. Sure. Yes, it happens, but it's harder to do. But I do think their argument is interesting and I respect it. I'm not sure I'm 100% there, but I actually am excited to see what it looks like in practice, which is I do get that trying to get money into the hands of people who aren't the sophisticated players and doing it fast, doing it nimbly could lead to some really beautiful things. I'm so curious to see what happens. Like I think the 3-year window that we're about to see is going to tell us a lot about the relative strengths and weaknesses of these ESA environments and what they should and could look like in the future.
Right. Well, I'm out in California where there, you know, obviously is no ESA and probably would be the last state, you know, to approve something like that. But I went to a conference recently in San Diego where there were people talking about this sort of underground market, you know, that is developing in California around micro schools. And some are still technically charter schools where either they're using an online provider for content, and then the in-person setting is what they're focusing on with real flexible schedule. And they're allowed to do, you know, a lot of dual enrollment types of arrangements. And then there are those that are not calling themselves schools in any way to avoid, you know, some kind of oversight. And, you know, they'll call them learning centers or enrichment centers. Or I learned about even a model that almost operates like a membership program, like a gym, you know, where you pay a fee and then your kid can go in and take this class or that class or participate in, you know, art or music or whatever. But there's a fee structure, a lot of creativity.
And this is what makes it, I think, fundamentally different than vouchers, right? Like one of the things I was talking about with Senator Meyer in the debate is he was like, well, what's different about this data? Because the data is not very flattering, if I'm being honest, to vouchers. Like, yes, I did my best to try to sell it because it was a debate, but the data isn't great about the performance of vouchers. And that was a inconvenient fact for the proposition I was debating at the AEI. But so Greg was asking, hey, like, well, what's different? Why can't we just look at these studies to say ESA? And I was spinning it the best I could. But then afterwards, I was thinking to myself, I was like, well, actually, it is very different in practice, because this unbundling effect in the micro schools, the explosion of that, and then the sheer scale of it all is going to be different. Now, the results could be just as bad, or they could be better. Honestly, I could see it going either way.
We may never know.
Because they don't get to test. And this is where, like, as somebody who's warm to ESAs, I almost think a confident move would be to open yourself up to the testing, right? Because then you will show that they're doing better. But I do think that there's a, and this is where I'm having a friendly debate with some of my friends on the right who support ESAs, is they don't respect standardized testing anymore at all. Like this used to be an exclusively a left-wing argument against standardized
tests
is now super dominant on the right. Whereas people like me, and they'll say you're this sort of stodgy old reformer and all that. I hope I've done enough to show I'm not that. But the idea that, and look, make it a short test. Can the kids add fractions on like denominators? Can they read, you know, like let's just know that they could do these basic things. And then we'll at least have a marker. That versus what's going on down in the street. And look, we can all stipulate that that's not the only thing that happens in a school, but at least it tells you whether this basic thing that we should all want our kids to be able to do is happening in one place or the other. And it also gives more information to parents to make decisions, which we should all want, you know?
Right. I think that a lot of micro schools, they don't test. And if they do, it is sort of built-in assessments in whatever online curriculum they might be using. You know, they use portfolios, you know, perhaps parents still want some kind of, you know, tangible proof of where their kids are at, you know.
Well, here's, and maybe this is like my final point on this, is I always think about the worst case scenario, right? And like the people who are way more pro ESA than me and say, you're focusing too much on the worst case scenario. But I've also been around the block to know that industries, like criminal industries, prop up around bad regulation, right? Like I just wrote a novel about the 90s in Staten Island where I grew up. And one of the sort of subplots is Medicare and Medicaid fraud and how that was like a rampant thing with the Russians in Brighton Beach for a period of time. And a lot of those things have gotten cleaned up. It's like, whenever you allow for this kind of stuff, it's not just one-off actors. Like sometimes there's sophisticated actors who can come in and clear money. So what can you do? Well, if there's a very basic minimum standardized test, you could find out, well, can kids not read? If the kids can't read, and then that should prompt the state to be like, what's going on at this school? Does it exist? Like, is it an actual school? And actually, so there should be kids who show up somewhere, right? Like they should go to a government testing center. This is where the people really hate it. It's like now like the government's involved, whatever. But they should show up. There should be an actual child with a birth certificate who shows up to that testing center and takes the reading test, right? That would help. Number two is uploading a standardized audit according to government accounting standards that says where your money's going, and then some spot checking, some percentage. Like with our schools, they used to come to the actual school and they would be like, pull up that receipt from this date, whatever. Just want to make sure you're not embezzling funds, right? And honestly, it wasn't that big of a deal. Not a huge deal. And you could even make money available for that extra so that the people who are doing this can afford to do those kinds of checks or allow the government to provide it for people, which I know everybody would hate. That's kind of the world I would like to see. Because then it's like no organized crime, no major avoidable theft. It seems like a very easy thing to comply with. And then we get the results where we can compare these things to one another.
Right. You know?
That's what I'm asking. Well, okay. Linda, this is great. We look forward to seeing your piece in the 74 next week about micro schools. Keep fighting the good fight. We love a great education journalist out there. So, you know, shout out to you and the rest of the team at the 74. Everybody out there, 74 is wonderful. We use it for so many of our education stories that we do here at the Lost Debate Show and the Branch period. So thank you to you and to all your colleagues for the work you do.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe. We don't bother you with advertising at the moment. So one thing you could really do for us as a solid is to go in there and leave a qualitative review and give us those 5 stars because they matter a lot. They also make me really happy to read about people who are having a good experience with the show. We will drop another episode later this week. Thank you very much, everybody.